July 18th, 2002, continuation of Ed Richard Chavez. The last time we spoke, we had gotten to the point where you returned from, I guess, paradise, you called it, back in 1952, paradise. Coming back to San Jose. There were a couple of things before we go back into continuing that chronology. When you were doing this moving, where were your parents?
In San Jose.
In San Jose. Your parents had moved to San Jose then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they were living there.
So that, in effect, was the family base then?
That's used, sort of, yeah. Right. San Jose, we, for some reason, we used to kind of go back. In fact, they stayed there, you know, till they died there.
Now, the move to San Jose was brought about by the need to work, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, it was always a need to work. Yeah. Wherever there was work, that's where we would be.
Now, because sometimes some of the books that we've read talk about a settling in with Delano, where you'd been earlier, as a base.
Because of work.
Because of the work and the fact that because of the pruning and so on, there was year-round work. But apparently there wasn't sufficient year-round work to keep you in Delano.
No, I mean, we had like... at least us and other people I knew, if you were migrants, you would kind of, you had your summer place and you had your winter work, you know. In other words, Delano was very good for winter work, you know, okay, which San Jose wasn't. It was better, in other words, you know, it's more happening, more work. And so was the Imperial Valley, like Brawley and Central and those places. So a lot of people used to come up for the summer to do the crops up north and pick the prunes, the cots, the grapes, and on. They would always return to Brawley for the winter. And that's, we did that until we found Delano, which was, we didn't have to make that go so far, which was even better, you know. And then we started staying in Delano.
And how was it again that you found Delano? I mean, what, was there someone here?
Yes, actually, she wasn't a blood sister, but my mother raised her, you know, she's like a sister, pero no era, you know, she was a cousin to us. She was my mother's niece, in other words, daughter to one of my mother's sisters that died. She kind of raised her. And so we were very close to her, of course, you know. She was already married, and her husband was always looking for... He knew the ropes, you know. He knew where the work was best and everything. And he found out. And then my mother wanted to be close to her, you know. I'm sure, you know, that had something to do with it too, you know. And it was easy to talk to him to staying in Delano. And they said, oh, there's a lot of work here. And, you know, we can work, you know. And there's, you know. And so we tried, and it was true, you know. We weren't working yet, but my dad did this winter work, which, you know, he liked it there. It was good. And they had a place to live. They had an extra house, so we rented from them. And so it worked out well, you know.
Okay. Anything else, Kent, that we wanted to...
So, but you spent from age about 14 to 18, 17, 18 in Delano, primarily in Delano, but you would leave in the summers and come back? Is that the way it worked?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. About those years, though?
Something like that, yeah.
That does raise another issue, which we actually talked about in the meeting last Friday, but not in the last interview, and that is the I don't know what to call it, the mythology of how many schools you went to. So can we talk a little bit about that?
Mythology, yeah. It is.
But no, this is mentira.
Sí. I think the less I heard, you know, and this was about 60, I said, my God, is it that, you know. Yeah. They just completely, everybody, you know, history goes, everybody adds a little onto it. But anyway, it's really, it must have been at least, you know, 10 schools, 10, maybe 12, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, and some of them we attended for 2 weeks, you know, and some others for 3 in a month, you know, and then we moved and so forth. But anyway, it's a different schools.
Yeah, as you had to move.
We had to move, yeah.
You were in different schools. Mm-hmm. Okay, now, going back to 52 and coming back from paradise back to San Jose. So let's pick it up.
You know, I was thinking, you know, it's very hard to think of something that it's still before 52, you know.
Okay.
It's way back, in fact, right. You know. We got stranded in 1 year. We got stranded. Those are the years that we used to go back to Brawley. Mm-hmm. And my folks were doing cotton there in Mendota. There used to be a lot of cotton around there. And it was a really rainy year. We were in a camping company, you know. And it started raining, and they couldn't work. And then, you know, it was just maybe tomorrow it's going to be dry enough to go pick, and then and it, some more rain would come, that sort of thing. And when they never did, I think they did go back. Anyway, they ran out of money. And what happened is that the people had just, you know, there were the little savings. Well, you have to eat, you know, so you weren't working, but you were still eating. And so we got stranded there, you know, and I remember very clearly that we're still there by Christmas. And the friends, the friends, they could all friends, the American Friends Service Committee.
Yeah, the Quakers.
They bought us some toys at Christmas, and I think it's probably one of the best Christmases we've ever had, you know, as far as toys, because we never got those kinds of things, you know. Yeah. Little things, but, you know, very nice about it. And then they bought a basket of food basket, and that was very, very well. That's the first time that I knew that there was other people that cared about people that, not knowing you or anything, it just, we didn't know about those things, you know, that there was people out there that did those kinds of things. So it was very nice, and in later years, I got to work for them, and I used to tell them the story, and, you know, they made the connection who it was. In those days, I didn't know who it was, but anyway. And anyway, we got stranded there, and we couldn't get out. Finally, yeah. We had a lot of fish because there were some canals there, and then people would go out there and fish, you know, and get carp, and they'd come and make soup with it or cook it somewhere or the other. And so I remember that we, it was kind of tight. We're still a little bit, we're still going to school. Anyway, we got out of there late. It was like almost like probably the first part of February. When we finally could get out of the camp, you know, I guess they went and worked a few days, and it was just enough to get some gas to get to Imperial Valley, and we did. They went and worked a couple of the day and a half or so, and got some enough gas, and let's go and pack things up, and we left. And but I remember it was a really, really rainy year, and we were living in a tent, you know. We weren't one of the lucky ones with a cabin. We had a tent outside, you know. All the cabins were taken, so we had to set up tent, you know. And it was cold. It's very cold, you know. I remember that heater? No, it wasn't such a word as heaters, you know. But I remember that we would become sheep because we were all small, you know. So they put us in like tacos, you know, like taquitos, you know, right next to you. And then they cover us with a couple of blankets. And then my dad had a really heavy tarp, and I mean, you know, like a lona, you know. Yeah. And then he put that over us, you know, and that was, we stayed warm, you know, so. And was, that, I forgot to mention that, because that was one of the experiences, you know, the old experiences that, you know, can remember, I guess, all the time. And, we got to Brawley, and, yeah, everything was normal after that week. So that year we started school. Well, school starts in September. We didn't get to, well, we were going to school in London. We were going to school in Mendota. We used to go to school, but we didn't get back to our school, which is Brawley, until February. Yeah, it's late, yeah. And I think that was, it seemed that was 41. No, it was 1940. It must have been 1940, because we came back, and in 41 we went back. But 1942, 42 is when we stayed in Delaney. From there on, we just didn't go back to the Imperial Valley anymore. I just thought I'd put that in there because it was part of the...
So, how many of you were there, like staying in the camp, the campos in Brawley?
How many got stranded there?
No, how many Chavez, families and people and cousins?
Wasn't too many cousins there. It was okay. There was some, but not that many. It was just friends, you know, people from all over the place, you know. We all got stranded there. We had the Castros were there, which were from Calexico. Our cousins, the Castros, were there. And then we had somebody else. I remember there was relative. I think.
But in your tent, it was.
Not just your family.
Just your family.
Yeah, no.
Including Manuel.
right? No, Manuel wasn't with us then, those days.
Wasn't, yeah.
He still wasn't with us, no.
Okay.
No, he came in later.
Manuel was one other thing before we get back to San Jose we wanted to ask you about. We've read some things about what your grandfather did in Mexico before he, you know, now your grandfather came up and he settled the ranch in Yuma, right?
Well, they came to El Paso first, and I guess he worked, I don't know what kind of work he was doing in El Paso.
But then he came over and homesteaded the Yuma
afterwards,
land,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Do you know anything about his life in Mexico before he got to El Paso? Nothing.
Huh? Nothing. Okay. Nothing, just that they were peons, you know, they were working for the Haciendado, you know. They came from this place called Hacienda del Carmen, which I went back and
that's when I went
to find, and it's still there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Still there. But,
yeah, because one of the books, it's a children's book for Primaria, makes the comment that said that your grandfather, what the word they use in the text was a slave. And I'm saying, no, probably peón asentado, peón, not, you know, slave is not the right translation.
No, no, it's not, you know.
I mean, it's just somebody there again, somebody.
I wonder where they would have gotten that.
Yeah, because, you know. No, 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 they get too dramatic, you know, No, no, they were peones. They were peones. They were workers, you know, they were, you know, chalanes or whatever you want to call them. You know.
You want to talk a little bit about the generally the living conditions in the camps and stuff?
Mm-hmm.
How did you? I mean, we know specifically about Brawley now, but
it was
about some of the really awful camps in the '60s too, and I was,
The there was one thing there that was in that part of the Mendota, and it's that black clay, you know, I mean, like slick, you know. Cars couldn't get out, you know. Cars were stranded, they couldn't get out, you know. And there was somebody pulling with a tractor and nobody was going to come. So what happened is that somebody managed to get out, I guess everybody pushed and something, you know. And they parked it, not in the camp, but outside, like by the street or on the something, you know. For an emergency, somebody needed to get somewhere, they could, but most of the cars were stranded, they were just in the mud and they couldn't get out, you know, couldn't get out, you know, until it dried a little and could get them out. Pero. So, like I said, it was very cold, I remember that, and we had to go to school and we, you know, just, well, every morning we had to, we had to trek to the mud to, because the bus wouldn't come in, they wouldn't get out, if it did, just came out to the, there was a little tiendita, was sort of like, had some gravel around it, and the bus would come there and turn it. And but we had to walk to that place, you know. And there was, you imagine, todos enlodados, todos los días, you know, we had to, you know, had to, well, our shoes were full of mud every day because you had to go out there, walk through there. It was really deep, you know, because it was really slick, you know, and it's just, it's amazing, you know. Like I said, the cars that were back didn't even try to get out there. They were in the back of the camp over there. There's no way they could get out. It's just like,
What was school like? I mean, you go through the mud, the bus picks you up, takes you, I guess, into Mendota.
No, we went, there was a little country school called Victoria School, you know, I still remember that name. It was school, you know, it's cool. We had some nice teachers there, you know, we had some teachers that understood us. And
Now, at one point you were saying you liked school. Did you still like school there at that point?
Yes, I did. Yes. Yes, I did. It was interesting. Cesar, this was the lower grades now that I remember. Cesar didn't go to that school because he had to go to Mendota. He was probably in the fifth or, I think from the fifth up or the fourth up, you'd go over there. But the lower grades, I was still in the lower grades, so we'd go to that. But I remember clearly that Cesar used to go to Mendota, you know, picked him up. Another bus picked him up and took him to Mendota. We had some good teachers there, you know. They were decent people, I remember right.
And while you, just one other question that we didn't ask last week. While you were on the Migrant Tail, did you usually work directly for the ranchers or did you have to deal with the contractors?
We preferred working directly for the rancher, you know, and every time that we could, we would do that, you know. But sometimes you had to work for a contractor, you know, because they were just like, we never liked that, you know. We never, because they would pinch you harder, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, they'd get more from any time that we could. My dad was very, 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 strong on that. He would like to deal with a grower himself, the ranchers, small ranchers. Yeah. And we're pretty lucky. Sometimes we were very lucky to get those kinds of deals. You know, we would, you know, we'd work directly with that person. Yeah. Yeah. Because we had some very bad experience. Not us, but everybody had a bad experience with the contractors. You know, they were just leeches. You know, just. Yeah.
They charge for every little
thing.
Whether you want a soda or not, you got one. It's coming off your check or whatever. I mean, at least that's later. Yeah. I don't know about back then, but they're probably charging you rent for the asadones and
everything that they could. You know, the ride was very it's very very common thing to charge you for the ride. They make their money there. All those things happen. That didn't happen to us too much because my dad wouldn't stand for none like that. You know. Let's get the hell out of here. Let's go. Vamos a otra parte. Let's other places. You know. He didn't take that kind of abuse. You know. He didn't take it. You know. So let's go. Let's go someplace else. There's other things to do. And he just didn't stand for it.
Okay. All right. Now we're back in San Jose in 1952, right? You've given up on paradise because of the floods.
Hijo, the floods, and hijo, man, they thought we were going to drown that time. So anyway, I told you how we got in Caesar's car and all that adventure with crossing a Golden Gate Bridge and heating. Oh, my goodness, I can just picture it now, you know. But anyway, it was all an adventure. It was an adventure, that's what it was, you know. It was just, poor people's adventures. I'm sure there was a lot of people that went through the same thing, you know, because of the old cars and, you know, problems and this and that. You know. But anyway, we made it back home to San Jose, and that's where we kind of started. I told you before we left, we were working for that Mexicano that was over there by himself. He'd been there for years, and he was an engineer and was a very smart guy. We started working with his cabinet shop, and so we got a little taste of what it was. Not to do the hoe or do the picking and stuff. So when we got back around that time, we started looking for, because we knew we wouldn't be able to do it picking peas and string beans and that kind of thing. You know. So we started looking. I put applications, I guess. I went one day, put applications, and I wanted to be a salesman or a salesperson or something, working at a store. And then there was, there was some good work. There used to be a place called the Steelers. It's a big, big company. It was a bean cutler division of food machinery, they call it. Okay. They make machines, you know. It's a factory, you know. And everybody would want to work there, you know. And there's others, the canned companies and stuff like that. So it's a better job. Better jobs than working in the field,
right?
That was like a step up, you know. Oh, I'm working in the canned company now, you know, making cans or whatever. And if you got to go to bean cutler, you were a señor, you know. And so we put application. Nobody ever even called to see. Nothing happened. It just all those applications just. Never heard from anybody, never called us, never nothing. So anyway, then somehow Cesar, through some acquaintance or something, told him that they were hiring at this box company, making boxes, like boxes for fruit, you know, like shoot boxes. And all kinds of boxes, I guess, but they were wood. Wood box factory, sort of was. Then he got on, you know. It's pretty good, you know. It looks steady, and he was sure to work every day, the rain or shine, he was working inside. And so, I mean, it was a step up, you know. And my brother-in-law, my sister's husband, we still had to go pick peas, then it started in 52, like there was, well, I guess all over, but in San Jose there was a housing boom, you know, like just, I remember later, there was full page ads, you know, asking for carpenters or laborers or whatever, you know, they just wanted people to come and work, no experience required, you know, just like all that kind of stuff, you know. So the trades were still pretty close to, and I'll tell you a story that's coming later from this. they were still pretty, the building trades were still pretty, they discriminated pretty bad against minorities. They didn't, there were no carpenters or electricians or plumbers, raza or anybody else or blacks or anything. They're still pretty lily white, you know. And, but laborers, yeah, it was wide open, you know, for picking showers was wide open. So we didn't have the money because you had to pay, the initiation was, in other words, you had to pay your initiation before you started working, which was, I don't know, $30 or something like that, you know. Well, who had $30 in those days? It was a lot of money. So we went and talked to the business agent, really, really, which became a very good friend, and afterwards we knew for a long time as De La Rosa. His name was José La Rosa or something. And we went and we told him, look, you know, say, we want to work, and but we don't have the money, we can't just say, ah, okay, ustedes parece que son buenos muchachos and all that kind of stuff. Says, you know, tienen $5, you know, pues I think we can get $5, okay. Pues denme los $5 y luego cada mes, cada que les paguen, cada mes me traen otros $5 hasta que acaben de pagar, which is was great, you know, it's a break, you know. And so we did that, you know, and that's how we got in. And we got into the laborers and Pusas, and the crew was 55 cents an hour, 60 cents an hour. It was, yeah. My man, it was big money. We're in the chips now, you know, we're making money. And so we started, and I had been working this, I finished paying, you know, my I didn't even finish paying my thing. You know, we're going to give $5 a week or whatever when you get paid. Before I had finished, I became a carpenter, you know. And that's the story I'm going to tell you about the discrimination that we encountered many times, you know. I was working as with the carpenters. I was a laborer, but, you know, working with the carpenters and bringing them boards and, you know, dig here and, you know, bring me that stake and all that stuff, you know. I go for you. And, but I was just like, I was a chavalo, I had a lot of, you know, and I wanted to, I loved it, you know, I loved it working around there. I just loved it working, you know, it was hard, you know. And this guy, the foreman saw that I was young and then I guess he felt pretty smart, you know, because I would bring things that the guys, they didn't have to tell me, I knew what they needed next and it was there and that sort of thing. And he started looking at me with started talking to me. And one day at lunch, he says, everybody wants lunch, and says, stay back, Rich, I want to talk to you. What did I do wrong?
Yeah.
And so he says, you know what, Rich, I've been looking at you. He says, you seem to be, I like you. So you move, and, you know, I like somebody that does that, you know, that has initiative and all that kind of stuff. He says, well, thank you. He says, why don't you become a carpenter? I don't know anything about carpentry. So, but you don't have to. Yes, but he says, then there's like some called an apprenticeship. You start like, and then you go, you work in there in the day and at night, two times a week you go to school, and then you know, they start teaching you. Really? He said, yeah, I'd like to have you, sir. You want to try? Oh. What do you have to do? He said, well, and I have to say yes, you know. I said, well, okay. And then he himself, you know, he was already a foreman. He gave me, I'll never remember, and I kept him for many, many years until finally when I went to a boycott, they got stolen. I left my tools and got stolen. But anyway, I used to keep that as mementos, you know. Yeah. He gave me a hammer. He's one of his old hammers.
Yeah.
He gave me a tri-square, a pencil, and a handsaw. So that's all you need for right now. And a tape, and a measuring tape. And then white coveralls. We used to use white coveralls in those days, an old pair of white coveralls. And I said, you're a carpenter now. So he says, go over to the union and tell them you're going to sign up and all that. You know, so the reason he sent me to go as an apprentice is he had just called, you know. He had called that morning for some apprentices. He says, we haven't had an apprentice in this hall for 2 months, Kenny. He says, there's no apprentice around, you know. There's none, you know. And so he says, well, there's openings, you know. So he sent me over there to get signed up. When I got there, they told me that they were, we're sorry, but we have too many apprentices that are out of work right now. We can't put you on, sorry. But we'll call you. Give me your name. You know, if something comes up, we'll call you. The same thing, you know. And so I went back more innocent, you know, just went back and told Kenny. So you're all fixed up, Rich. He said, no, so they said they had too many apprentices and then they couldn't put me on the stuff, but they took my name and everything, going to call me later. And they just says, come on, get in the truck. Says, well, Drucken, he started, I mean, he peeled out of there. I mean, not just like he was. He just peeled out of there. And everybody, pasó con Kenny, and ya lleva Richard, you know. We went back, and he drove straight into the hall. He says, Jorgerche, you son of a bitch. And just the way that's how he greeted him. You goddamn bunch of racists, this and that. You know, wait, Kenny, what? This is a big company, you know. I mean, they employ thousands of workers, you know. The guy was throwing his weight around. But what's happening? He says, how come you know, the Asians, you know. And then they started blaming each other, and the secretary said, no, no, you're a bunch of racists, goddamn. Sign this guy up right now before I sue you. You know, sign me up, you know. But that's the mistake they made, you know, because once they signed me up, then I started getting raza in there. Now you're going to sell raza, you know. Yeah. But I broke the ice in San Jose. They weren't no carpenters, you know. And that's one of the, I broke the ice because that incident that happened, you know. This guy just happened to like me, and he sent me to start as an apprentice. And they refused me. Even though I had to tell them in the morning, they hadn't seen an apprentice around the hall for two months. When I went there, they said, we have all kinds of apprentices that are working. They're just obvious, a discrimination thing, you know. And so he went out there, and man, he was boiling. He's hot, you know. And they signed me up. They signed me up right in front of them. That's how I became an apprentice. Carpentry, and then I served my apprenticeship and went on to do that, you know. And this guy liked me a lot. He said, he says, Richard, I know, says that, you know, there's, you know, I know what's happening. There's discrimination, this all that, and I hate that kind of thing. And so he told me all this stuff. He's a good guy. He said, look, I'm going to tell you something. When you're working here with me, I like you, you're a smart kid, and you learn everything right away and everything, you know. In fact, I was still an apprentice. And he had me doing layout and things that old carpenters had been carpenters for years. I was anxious to learn anything he showed me. I pick it up, you know. I was doing layout, and then some of the old guys didn't like it, you know. But I was shooting grade, you know. Not a lot of people know how to set that an instrument, all them takers, nothing. But they didn't. They had never had the chance to do it, and I was already shooting grade. And like, God, no, this guy just elevated me. He taught me a lot of stuff. Not only in school, but on the job, he taught me a lot of stuff. So I was very lucky, and I learned fast, you know. I learned things that other guys didn't know. So anyway, I stayed with him. Says, the reason I'm telling you this, Richard, you have to know a lot, is because you're not always be going to work for me. After this job is over, you're going to go work for somebody else, and they're going to give you a hard time. So you don't have to be as smart as they are. You have to be smarter. Don't you ever forget that, you. And I'll tell you, you met a Mexicano, he was era big in staff, era como, I don't know, like, nombre como, big in staff.
German
parece, verdad?
Yeah.
Kenny big in staff. He said, you have to be smarter, Richard, because they're going to discriminate. But if you're smarter, they can't do it, because you're going to know more than they do. So I'm going to teach you everything that I can, and you learn by the books, and learn pronto, you know. He gave me a lot of good consejos, you know. So I appreciate it, and I did, you know. I just, puse a usar, and I learned, you know. And, you know, I became a pretty decent mechanic, you know. I had my first, I was running my first job as a big job here in Delano, here in Rich Grove, building a coal storage. I had 60, about close to 60 carpenters and about 30 laborers under me, and I was the superintendent there. And I was still an apprentice. Yeah, my last year's apprentice. Yeah. And there was a big, some of the guys didn't care, you know, but they were always were jealous, I guess, you know, some of the older journeymen, and they went to the union, complained, how come I was, a superintendent, I wasn't even a carpenter yet, you know, and you know, they, again, you know, sort of like, you know.
When was that? That's
it was in 56, 55, 56. No, I'm jumping, but I'm
saying, yeah. We wanted to tie that in.
So anyway, you know, they came out, and these business agents came, and they talked to the to Oakland, which was the main camping construction, was said, no, that guy's there because he can do the job, you know, and anybody can do a job, and I don't care, he's never had a day of carpentry, he's going to do a job for me. And so that was the end of that, you know, and that settled it, you know. But they, because I was an apprentice, I shouldn't be running a job, because, you know. So anyway, it's one of the stories that. And
what was the name of the company again? The construction
camping construction
camping
camping C A M P I N G camping.
Okay.
out of Oakland. In fact, when that job was done, they wanted me to travel with them. They're going to go to Oregon. I said, no, I don't think so. You know, I'm just not ready for that. You know. That's the only job I did for them. And,
so your base then was still San Jose then?
No, it was Delano. I was Delano. By 56, I was in Delano. Yeah.
Okay,
I had been there. And let's go back to... I just jumped many...
No, that's good.
I just jumped a few years there. We were in San Jose when we came back. I told you that I got into construction. So I came 6 years ahead.
Yeah. Cesar went to work in a box factory.
In a box factory.
Was that unionized too?
Yeah, it was unionized. Okay. It was our first union gig for him and for myself too. You know? I belonged to the laborers union for about 3 weeks, and then I joined the carpenters. And that's in that time, you know, we were just weren't working in the fields. We had spun out, you might say, that vicious circle, you know. That was a time when we met Fred Ross, and then that's when CSO. We got our first dates of CSO and so forth.
How did you meet him? I mean, how did it happen?
Fred Ross had just come.
You're working as a carpenter.
Yeah. Let me tell you how it happened. Fred Ross had just come from Los Angeles, where they had organized a CSO. It was already functioning. They had a chapter, you know. They'd done some good stuff. And, you know, they had already elected their first ever city councilman, Mexicano city councilman in Los Angeles, and which was Ed Roybal, you know.
Yeah.
And anyway, he was. Then they figured that there was a lot of other places in not in California, but in the Southwest. That needed CSOs, you know, because, you know, the thing was the same all over.
Yeah.
And they figured that San Jose would be the next logical place to organize. Mm-hmm. Fred Ross came to San Jose, you know, and organized. He comes into a town without knowing anybody, and in 2 or 3 days he knows a lot of people, makes connections and everything, you know. So Fred Ross' training was that he went to the Catholic Church first, you know, La Iglesia del Barrio.
Yeah.
What better place to go, you know? We did the same. I did the same thing, you know.
Yeah.
When I was organizing, I'd go to a church and I said, "I just want to meet you, Father." And by the way, do you know any? Okay, yeah. That's the way Fred did it. I'm sure you're. So anyway, he went and he met Father McDonald, which is a parish priest there at Guadalupe, which we used to go. And he told him what his program was and everything, and that he was looking for people that might be interesting in forming an organization. You know, told him a little about CSO. And Father McDonald was del movimiento también. He was, you know, he liked to do a lot of stuff for people and all that. And so he says, yeah, there's these young guys, there's these young Chavez families. They have, you know, 2 or 3, 4 guys in there, and sisters and all that. You know, it might be a good place to start, you know. And so, okay, so, and then he kind of, you know, took note of who to talk to. Him. And then at the same time, he met the same day or next day or whatever, you know, he met this health nurse and also told him about the Chavez family. So he said, there might be something there. So I guess, you know, just because, you know, we were a lot, I guess. And so anyway, he came to see us, you know, we weren't there, and he says that Helen would tell Caesar, this is, there's a gabacho that came looking for you. He's a tall guy. He's got a suit and everything. What does he want to sell us, you know? Because that's the only time that they would come, you know, trying to sell you something or, you know. No, he didn't say anything about sales, just that something about an organization that he wants to talk to you. Okay, so we went there. So finally, about the second, third time he came around, we were there. They tell him to come, you know, at the time we come from work and after we had supper and all that, so we can talk to him. And sure enough, he came, you know, after supper, and, you know, he sat down and talked to him and started explaining to us about CSO in Los Angeles and what had happened, how, where it came from, who sponsored it, and so forth. And that was the history. And that they had done this in Los Angeles, they had done that, and police discrimination, they were fighting this, and then, you know, they had registered voters, and they had elected the first city council, and all that. And all that stuff we liked, you know, we were ready. You know, I told you before, we were ready for it, you know.
Yeah.
We were just waiting for it to happen so we could join. And sure enough, we jumped on the bandwagon. We liked his program and said, yeah, let's do something. We'd like to help you or something, whatever, you know, you need help. And so we were probably among the first ones in San Jose that got started with And we got into it so I mean, it was just like a bison, you know, just like I said, we were ready for it. We were waiting for something like that. It was something that dropped out of the sky, you know. And we'd go to work, and se me hacía largo el día. I was looking at the watch, it was going to be 4:30, so I could go home and go to work with CSO, you know, go out there house to house, and, you know, and whatever we were doing, you know, register.
What were the issues that you were working on at that point? I mean, what were the organizational issues?
There was many, hijo. There was many, 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 a lot of stuff, you know. Some people, they set up an office right away, you know, they opened an office. And they would help, and it wasn't a referral agency. Now we would take you by the hand and help you, and they would let you know. I never worked in the office, you know, but other people, women and other people that, you know, they would do like income, this, even the short form. Some people had time in a letter. They would write letter or school problems with the kids. You know, I'd go in with the parents to fight the police brutality, welfare cases, and immigration, a lot of immigration cases. And, you know, it's easy. Immigration, yeah. It's easy. Anybody could do immigration almost, yeah. You know.
But it was a real issue in the 50s because of the changes that were taking place.
Yeah. But, you know, there was all kinds of things. And then us, we were doing, we were going out there and petitioning the getting signatures to fix the potholes at Salsipuedes, you know. Hay unos hoyos que se tumía el carro, you know. I mean, they're little things, but to us were big things, you know. It had never happened before, you know. A street light in the corner of San Antonio and Jackson or something, you know. It was dark. Once after it was dark, you couldn't see. It was just like going into very small things now, but they were big things to us then, you know. And then we were getting victories like that, you know. And then we started, he told us about how they had elected Ed Roybal to the city council. And we could do the same thing in San Jose, you know. This, we kind of said, man, not in San Jose. You know, we didn't say it out loud, but, yeah. You know, because we had never seen things like that. And then we started, you know, then the politicians started, when they saw that we were registering a lot of people. We had a voter registration once, and I think it was, we registered, it was a big, big number, I don't know. 5,000, I think, 5,000 new vote, more than 5,000 new registered voters. It was a big chunk in San Jose. It wasn't anywhere, I guess, you know, in those days. And the mentality just started coming around, you know. I mean, they started coming to our meetings, and we started, why are they here? Because, well, they're here because you're registering people, and there's some vote there, there's some power. And we started learning how it connected, you know. And so we liked, the more we saw, the more we liked it. And we worked, there were no weekends. Our weekends were doing something for CSO, going door to door, knocking on doors and talking to people and things like that. We just really got into it.
Your wives were involved in this too, right?
See, it was a whole family thing, you know. Yeah, yeah. They were very supportive of what we were doing, you know. And, we got into it, and that's where CSO, that's where Cesar got, you know. Like also, Fred saw that Cesar had a lot of, initiative and a lot of savvy, you know. He could become a good organizer. He started to become a good organizer, you know. And so he kind of stuck to him and just nurtured him, you know, until he said, Cesar, in basis, I mean, he said, we have to, now San Jose is established and is running well, is doing good things. We have to, there's other parts of the state that need CSOs, and I want you to be one of my organizers. And he started shaking and said, but I know, Fred, I'm not ready for it by myself. I can work with you. And I said, no, you are, Cesar. I know what I tell you, you are. I'm going to send you to Madera, I think. Madera was the first. I said, Madera. Yeah, here's Madera. We need to open an office in Madera, and we want you to organize Madera. So he sent him, and sure enough, he set it up, and he says, now you got to set up Bakersfield. Came Bakersfield, formed a chapter, and it was just like, he started like, he became an organizer. Well, he had, in other words. And Fred was very, very impressed, very pleased, and, you know, finally they made him a director of the whole thing. He was the executive director of CSO. And that's when, years later, that he quit, you know, because he wanted to, yeah, when he told him that he wanted CSO to start, you know, some real issues, you know, I mean, going to the real issues that, our people had, you know,
yeah.
And that was farm workers, you know.
Do you know when that was that he went to Madeira?
It had to be in probably 53, I would say. Either late 52 or 53.
So Fred Ross showed up in San Jose in Sosopete the first year that you were back, huh?
Yeah.
52?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We were just like, we just connected. I mean, just like everything is, you know, I guess everything is its plan, you know.
And you continued to work with CSO in San Jose?
I didn't stay in San Jose after that. After, in 52, I came to Delano. After we had set up San Jose and everything. I went to Madeira to organize, and I came to Delano my first wife was from Delano. Her mother was, family was in Delano. And so, you know, there was, I had an uncle. Well, remember that gal I told you it was like a sister?
Mm-hmm.
Her husband. Wanted, so he was going to build a restaurant and some apartments and some small stuff, not. And he said, can you do it? And I says, well, I was just barely beginning, you know, I started in 52, just my first year apprentice. He says, well, I think so, you know, I think I can help you. And so anyway, he says, anyway, if you're not the guy who's going to lead it, I want you to work on it anyway with somebody. I'll get somebody with more experience. And he did. He got somebody, un señor que, you know, he was a pretty firm mechanic, you know. And I worked with him, and I picked up some more from him, you know, the old stuff. And so anyway, I came back to San Jose, to Delano. And I stayed in Delano. I stayed. And then later, we organized the chapter in Delano. I did that, you know, and became the first president. And so it was still CSO, but we had a Delano chapter of the CSO. I was still with it, yeah. Yeah.
So what were you working at then, in coming back to Delano?
As a carpenter.
So you continued as a carpenter?
Yes, and then I continued my schooling here in Bakersfield. In fact, I graduated from Bakersfield.
Okay.
I moved my cart and everything to Bakersfield, you know, and
yeah.
I continued working as a carpenter and going to school. And I graduated here, you know, 3 years later, 2 years later.
3 years later. And so once you had your card, you didn't have any trouble moving it to Bakersfield or anything? You didn't run into it?
No,
try to keep you out or anything?
No, I was already in, so
yeah.
Okay. That's very hard for them to do that, too. Mm-hmm. So, I came to Bakersfield. It was a lot of work. It was moving all over. It was just, you know, they were building houses all over the place, you know, just like, and you just show up and you just, okay, start here. You didn't even, we're just waiting for you.
Do you remember what kind of money you were making as an apprentice?
Yeah, when I started in San Jose, I think I started at 76 cents an hour. The Germans were making 95 cents, I think. And I started like at 72 or 76, I remember. Something like that. Or 66 or something like that. And then, but it went up pretty fast after that, you know. Yeah, it was, but I'm talking way back, this is in 51, 52, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you're organizing the CSO chapter in Delano, what are the issues? Same type of issues?
Same thing. The issues were same all over. There was already an organization in Delano called LACA, Latin American Citizens Association, LACA, L-A-C-A, LACA.
Mm-hmm.
And they had been organized for a few years, you know, pretty much sort of like a social club thing, you know, and some, they did a little stuff, but they weren't all into doing that, you know. And so when CSO started becoming the thing for the Chicano, for the Mexican Americans, you know, everybody wanted to be part, you know, like, you know, it was a brand new thing, you know, and it was a good thing, you know. So LACA, the same people in LACA, we formed the CSO, you know. So we'd be part and go to the state conventions and all that stuff, you know. They wanted to be part of a bigger picture, you know? And so it was good. You know, we did a lot of good stuff in Delano. We did a lot of curb and gutter, sidewalks, lights, fixing up the streets, and you know, school discrimination, police brutality, and the same thing. You know, income tax returns and all that stuff. You know, and the same thing. You know, helped with the same issues. They were all over the place. So we did the same thing.
So how long did this continue? You're working as a carpenter, basically living in Delano, right?
Mm-hmm.
And CSO is your activity.
Mm-hmm.
So how long did this continue?
I think it was for at least a couple of years, I would say 53, 54, 50, probably 55, you know, something like that. But I wasn't the president after a couple of terms. Somebody else was the president, but I was still. I don't remember if we folded up in Delano. I don't remember what happened to CSO. I think it folded up. It kind of just lost interest or something. And then we formed another club. It was at the Ideal Social Club. There was strictly social, you know. I mean, we're all young couples, you know.
Yeah.
Young couples. And so we tried to do, even though it was Ideal Social, we still did some stuff like, you know, school problems and police problems and all that. But that wasn't our main focus. Our main focus was to make dances and go have fun and party and all that, you know. And we were there for another couple of years, you know. And it was a good little club, you know. We had a lot of fun. We did things together and all that.
You use one of the salones in Delano?
Helped me with Delano, you know. Just
Fresno had a chapter.
Fresno. That's a good chapter.
I remember the growing up here.
Fresno, Visalia, and then
their dances, their functions.
And this is around 19, probably by. The time passed, you know, like, you know, it was pretty much the same, you know, like, you know, I was getting my business going in Delano as a carpenter, you know, and I had a pretty good little thing going, you know, and I wasn't working for, I worked for many, many, many outfits, but after that I started working for myself and I was just doing good and, you know, I started getting bigger and, you know, even though I wasn't a contract, I had more work than I could handle and it was good for me, you know, I was doing good. And that time Cesar, we kind of separated. At that time Cesar was it was in Oxnard. He was doing the Oxnard chapter, and he had this first incident of farm work, you know, because he already had that in mind that he had to. And I think that's what really, really clinched his idea of organizing farm workers. He had a run in with some. I don't even know the issue exactly how it is, but I think I know how it was. That there were some locals that were displaced because they brought in some contract workers from like braceros or something.
Yeah,
you
some
know? Braceros. And it didn't supposed to be that way. They'd had to get them in when there was work for that everybody was working. In this case, they displaced a whole bunch of locals and, you know, brought the braceros, and that he fought then and won it. You know, that was his first taste of victory. You know. Yeah, they sued the state or somebody, and they won, you know. And he says, this can be done because he used the same tactics as CSO in organizing, you know, house meetings and all that stuff. And he says, if it works for CSO, it can work for farm works, you know. That's where he got his idea, you know. This is already in 1961, I think, you know, 60 or 61, getting very close to where. And by 62, that's at the convention of 62, that's when he said, in 60... I think it was a convention early 62, when he asked CSO to come in and let's take farm workers as one of organizing farm workers as one of our projects. Everybody, you know, they shied away from it. You know, it was. He used to tell me that they were too cozy. You know, they knew Mr. Politician very well. They had become friends. They didn't want to ruffle any feathers and that kind of thing, you know. We respected. Why should we go into something that's controversial? And, you know, we're very well respected organization. They respect us and we're doing this and we're doing... all kinds of reasons why not to go in La Chinga to organize farm workers. So Cesar said, well, I'll just have to do it myself. I'm going to quit, you know. Nobody believed that he was going to resign. He did. And, you know, I don't remember exactly what happened, but anyway, he resigned, and they made some petitions to put him back and all. They said, no, I'm serious, no, you guys don't wanna, you just become very comfortable already, you know, you don't want to, you forgot what we were organized for, you know, so I'm gonna go out there and do it. I'm gonna go out there and start organizing farm workers. I can't do this anymore. And so he quit, and then Dolores quit too. She came with him, you know, and then Gilbert Padilla quit and came with him, and others, you know. So, and so he bought some, not that those aren't, they followed, in other words, you know, because he said, I'm going to go out there by myself. And that's when he came to Delano. He moved to Delano in 62, I think, you know. And yeah, it was very heavy because I was in Delano already, you know.
Yeah.
And so my house was the very first office, you know. In fact, we had that telephone number for, I kid you not, this is in 62. I got the last telephone bill by mistake that was sent to me here. From that number in Delano, just a couple of 3 years ago. Hmm. that was the office. He would receive calls here, my wife would take calls during the day, you know, and then he would, you know, whatever. And that was for a couple of years, I think, or more. It was the only phone, you know, we had. It was out of my house. And so he came and started doing his running around, you know, and I used to, well, I was pretty busy, you know. I was doing. I had a lot of work, but on weekends, you know, he says, "You want to go with me to Fresno or Visalia next Saturday?" So, well, I had okay. I had told somebody I was going to go there, but let me cancel. And I told him, so you know, I can't do it. I'm going to come, you know, Monday. I'll be there Monday. Whatever. You know, I made arrangements and I'd go with him. And so we travel up and down. He's going to Hanford. I'd go with him. I'd drive him and go to Hanford, and we'd talk, and you know, we spent a lot of time together. But he was doing his thing, but I was still connected to my job, you know, still doing my carpenter work, you know. And that went on, and then he opened his first little office, and I went and remodeled it for him. And I built his first desk. He didn't have a desk, and so I custom built a desk for him. Oh, he had the desk for years and years. Somebody finally, you know, and that's moviditas. Yeah. Somebody got things started getting big and lost track of things, you know. So somebody ran away with it or something. I don't even know what happened. But I used to. Finally, and then by that time I was working with the French Service Committee. Remember I told you later I worked with the French. We were building this. We did this project called self-help housing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You're familiar with it?
Yeah.
Okay. I was one of the founders of that program. Okay.
Yeah. Talk to us a little bit about that. You know, so what?
Oh, it was very interesting. Yeah. Oh, it was a good, real good program. Mm-hmm.
How did it work? I mean, I heard about it, but
okay.
Tell us how it worked.
This was a program that the American Friends Service Committee started, the Quakers again, the same guys that gave us Christmas in 1941 over there when we were little. Were the same guys I was working for then, you know. They started this program with the idea, they call it sweat equity, okay? That they could get them, people could get loans very, 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 at a very low rate, you know, préstamos,
yeah.
Or sometimes without interest, loans without interest, you know. But they had to build their own houses, you know. And we made that miracle happen. It's still going. It's still, yeah. Still in self-help. It's all over the country now, but we started right here in Tulare County. That's where it started.
Yeah.
We started in Orosi. That was the birthplace of that. Our office was in Visalia. I used to go to work to Visalia every day from Delano. And I told you that I had my business going. I was doing very well, you know. But again, the social conscience thing doesn't let you, you know.
So you were providing the technical assistance and the know-how on the house building.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was already doing well
where
I was, you know. But somehow this guy, Howard Washburn, which was the one that really started, the main guy. You know, I was second. I was the first guy he hired. We worked together. Heard about me and came to see me and explained the program and everything, and that was my business. The first time that my business went, stayed on the side, you know, and looked and said, we can help people, and, you know, just us, right, on our LS, or always trying to do, help somebody, you know. And I says, how can people build their own house? They don't know. They got to know something. No, Richard, he said, they don't have to know anything. You're going to be there, you know. See, you're going to be, you'd be surprised, because he had already built some. You know, he'd built two or three already. So you'd be surprised how fast people can learn, you know, when it's to their interest, you know. Do you think so? I know so, Richard. So he was a good organizer, too. Howard was going to organize. So he organized me. Before I know, I was working for the Friends Service Committee. I took a cut and pay, I don't know, three times what I was doing. Or, anyway, I went to work with him because I wanted to do that, you know, and to help people. And so we went, and we, sure enough, we started that program, and I was like, they call it construction supervisor, you know. I would draw plans and everything, you know, for the houses we were going to build. I would draw the plans, and then people would choose which plan they would. You know, this is incredible. I mean, this is incredible. What's this? This, I'm talking about 1964 and 65, maybe. I think my last year was 65. Probably even 63. I know all of 64, but part of 63 and maybe part of 65. I'm very bad at dates, but I, you know, it kind of fits in there. And we were building houses, three bedrooms for 2,700 with hardwood cabinets, tiles in the showers and the kitchen and tile floors, you know. Nice paneling inside, you know. Nice three little bedroom houses for $2,700, but people had to, they had to do the work, you know. The four bedrooms, this was the four bedroom, it cost $3,400, I think, $3,400. It was a four bedroom, a large family. We had a lot of kids, a guy, but they had to do the work, you know. And like, remember my words were saying, but Howard, they can't do it if they're not carpenters, you know. Like, I experienced, you know, I was younger, and Howard was, had been around for a long time in construction, you know. He, the experience, this is an older person talking to a younger person that still needs to learn, you know. He said, no, Richard, it can be done. I assure you, you know, that's your fear, you know, don't have to worry about it. Well, one of the best cement finishes I ever had in all the jobs that I did, because I did projects in Orosi, in Tulare, in Early Mark, and Delano. I didn't do Delano or McFarland. I quit by then, but I did some projects in those areas. My best cement finisher was a young lady. She was a housewife. She was young, in her 20s, early 20s. She became my best cement finisher. She would do all the sidewalks and in every. I had a guy he drowned, and him and his sons drowned in a fishing trip. But you can tell when you're an organizer, I'd already, you know, you get good at knowing, at seeing somebody and knowing that their abilities. I guess something about being an organizer, you know who can do and who can't, you know. And this guy, I saw him, like, I remind me when I started, remember I told you that I was to be, what do you need, or, you know, listo, you know, anything. I was just there trying to outthink the person, you know, and all that kind of thing. Well, this guy had that, it's in late, years later, I'm talking 51, this is in 64, or 63, that's 11 years after that happened. And he had the same thing, you know, this guy. And, because I used to do all the layouts, you know, And at first, you know, you learn a lot of stuff with people. So great, you know, working with people. You know, in our language, another carpenter, you know, we do marks with a pencil, and you know what that mark means, you know, okay? Just, you know, put an X, a C, or a T, they know what to put in their nail and everything, you know. Well, I started doing that with the people, every, you know. But before I came, you know, where there were C's, they would have to do a long stud. C is cripples for a window, you know. You leave the space open, you know, that means they're going to be shorter stuff, you know, or trimmers, you know, under the. And he says, no. ¿Qué dice aquí? Ah, se olvidó, you know, that kind of thing. And I said, there's got to be a way, you know. Y un día estaba pensando, it's a color code, you know. And so, never had a mistake again that I can remember. Blues were full studs. C's were cripples, you know, or trimmers, or the red were trimmers, and the yellows were little short ones. Never again did that happen. They just saw them, aquí un largo y aquí no, aquí no. Deja esos que quedan cortitos. Just color code. They were still using that. Years later, I went to visit a project. They were still using that method, you know. So I said, I invented this. With carpet, no, you just everything in pencil, but they just read what it is, and you know. But then that worked very well. So there was a lot of this guy that I was telling you. I hadn't taken it was like worse than CSO or the union, you know. You just didn't take any time off because the weekends was when they could work all day, you know, Saturdays and Sundays, you know. But I was there during the week too, so I was working 7 days, you know. Finally, Howard said, Richard, take some time off for Pete's sake. You're going to burn yourself out. You take some time off, you know. They can do it, you know, just tell. So this I had we had the floors already and all the lumber there and everything, and we had the plates, and this guy had already, I explained to him, and he'd say, I mean, esta esquina lleva uno, dos, tres, barrotes, y lo y otro. I explained to him, you know, and I says, I'm not going to be here tomorrow or Sunday, I'm going to take the day off, I got to go up and do some fishing, something, I'm still in the local, I got to rest you, and you think you can do it? Oh, see, yes, Richard, I think I can do it, you know, okay. And then you have people, okay, so everything's on the ground, everything is just lay out this for me, and he laid out some for me, and it was right, you know, as I said, okay, thank you. And, you know, this is Friday, I came by the morning, and there's two houses, all the frames standing up, you know. Hijo, talk about a surprise, you know, talk about being surprised, you know. Guy going out there, hijo, man, I couldn't believe it. The guy, you know, you just imagine somebody like that, then that relieves you. You don't have to be there watching everything they do, you know. That's what Howard was talking about. They can learn and then they can do it themselves, you know. And so, you know, and then, sure enough, you know, the only thing is he cut a couple of timbers that didn't, but there wasn't nothing to compare what they did, you know. Instead of 4x6s, he cut me some 4x8s I had for the garage or something like that. But it's nothing, you know. It's nothing. And other than that, it was all just the bracing, you know. He wasn't sure how to do the bracing, but he had the braces cut in everything, but not nailed, you know. And I showed him how you brace when you how you plumb all the corners, and I explained the whole thing, and they did it. Yeah. And from there onward, just imagine taking all that load off of me. You know, I could spend my time, you know, going after. Because I had to buy the material. Yeah. I had to buy materials, and I had to buy everything. I had to order everything. You know? And so I was a really that. In fact, he was that same guy. Was hired as a when I left. He was hired as a supervisor. Because he had learned it, you know. He had learned it so well, he was hard as a supervisor. Out of never having no construction experience, most houses that we built, that project, he became enough to, he learned, learned like that, you know. The otros, you can spend 20 years with them and they just never get it through the head. You just can't do it, you know. You know? So that's the beauty about working with people that you can get somebody to do it, to learn it, to you know, and it's a great feeling when that happens, you know. So anyway, that was a good experience. Self-help housing. I did about 3 or 4 projects, and they were all real good, you know. But we would pour the concrete and everything, you know, do the plumbing. We do our own plumbing. I showed somebody, I had a black guy, and I showed him how to do plumbing. Oh, this is easy, Richard. And just by the time we were already using plastic pipe, you know. Mm-hmm. To us, cut and glue and, you know, nothing to it, you know. So we got it pretty good, you know. And electrical, a guy out of Early Mart, Arturo, I forget, Solis or something like that. I just showed him how to do electrical. He'd wire the houses. He'd run, he would do the electrical. No que otra cosa le fallaba, you know, decía, no, mira aquí, mira, te equivocaste, and you see, this goes with this. Ah, see, I can see, I am equivocado nomás, but I understand you. So he wired the houses, pull all the wiring, and he wasn't sure about the connections, so I'd be there when you do the connections, you know, to tie wires together. He So, I mean, it was just a lot of fun, you know, a lot of fun. It became fun afterwards, and very, very satisfying, because you could see that people were getting their houses, and they were very proud of it. And so that was a good period there. And then after that, that's when, at that point, it was, I'm to about 1960, probably 62, early 62. When Cesar was already, you know, I used to go with him on weekends. Remember, I tell you, I'd go this and that and do stuff. But he said, he came and says, "Richard, he says, we're into something." He says, "And this is going to take. I'm going to need some good people around me, somebody I can trust and work with." And so, he says, "I'm afraid you're going to have to hang up your hanger. I'm afraid you're going to have to hang up your hammer, man." Okay, what do you mean? Well, I said, "Give it up, you know. You have to come and help me, be an organizer." That's kind of, I wasn't expecting it like that, you know. He says, "Well, Caesar, that's a big decision. You know, I'm a married man, and I have a wife, and I have to consult with you, and I have to, you know, because, you know, she's..." And says, "Well, you do that, because I'm going to need you full time now. Part time's not going to get it, you know." This is getting serious, you know. And so I did talk to my wife, and she said, "Well, you know," and then the kids were tan chiquitos, you know. "Yeah. Hey, you guys, if daddy does this, you know, go help." They were all excited, helping Tio Cesar, you know. "Like, you know, you're used to, you know, you had it pretty good compared to other little kids right now, you know. Yeah. Son, I'm making a little better money than somebody else, you know. And you're not gonna have a lot of things that you have now, you know." They were as little kids. I was explaining to them that they were going to things were gonna be a little different, you know. If I went to work as a volunteer, yeah. And then I told my wife too, and says, "No, that's really what you want to do." I says, "We'll manage somehow. We'll go along." Ya tenía mi casa pagada. I had already built my house, and you know, I'd already had my house, you know. And this says, "We're going to work just for food, you know, just for food and the bills, you know. We're going to pay our electrical bill and our gas bill and our food, and that's it. There's not going to be money for anything else. It's going to be hard, so you better think it." I said, "No," they all decided that they wanted to do that. Just, okay. So I told Cesar, "Okay." Anyway, so I talked to the family. I said, "It's okay." I went. And then I became full.
That was before the convention or after?
No, during the convention I was still working. Mm-hmm. I was still just part-time. I was just still part of the group, you know. But when I came on full-time, yeah, I had 64 or 65 when I came on.
The same year as the grape strike, or year before?
The same year as the grape strike, just a little before the big strike, you know. And so we didn't. Things changed, you know. I had a good little business going, and I gave it up. And for the next 25 years, I was. Then the grape strike came on, and then all that thing happened.
Before we start going into that, I wanted to go back to one thing. During the 50s, you were here as a carpenter based in Delano. And now, that was the time of the attempt of the FFL. Al Green?
Al Green.
Yeah. Mm. They attempted unionization efforts now. What happened? What, you know, how did you see that, and how did it have any effect?
I wasn't into that at all. I had no idea that was happening. That was, you know, I didn't.
You were busy.
Yeah. I didn't, you know, I didn't even know what was happening. Yeah. It's happening in, nothing was happening in Stockton mostly, you know. Yeah, he tried to organize, and I think it didn't have much success, you know. But there were some remnants of it, you know. It's that was what Dolores was part of, you know.
Right.
And Dolores kept it going, and, you know, kind of struggling with it. And then when Cesar started the it came together years later, a few years later.
Yeah, it was almost 10 years, right? 65 in the back about.
Probably 56, I'm like, yeah, it was a few years.
Yeah, that was a, you know.
So I knew about it afterward, but I didn't know when it was happening. I could care less what they were doing. I didn't.
Well, I think I was either in, I was just starting high school.
This is my ideal club day, so yeah, okay. I didn't know too much about anything else.
Okay. I wanted to ask a little bit about ideal club days. Do you remember where did you go to the clubs and the band? Did you have local bands? And
we had local bands, but we also bought in some good stuff from the outside, you know. Yeah, we were promoters. Yeah. We were promoters. We made a lot of money for the club that way, you know.
Uh-huh.
We had, and you'll probably remember this one, you know, the Rhythm Kings. Remember the Rhythm Kings? They were the ones that played for us most of our dances. But then we would bring in Johnny Otis, and then we would bring in name bands, you know, from outside once in a while, you know. And, who else did we get in? It was so long ago that we brought in sometimes some good names, you know.
Some swing bands or Tejanos or...
No. It was all... No, not Tejano. It was... That came in later, you know. Okay. We didn't even know about Tejano music those days.
Yeah?
No. It wasn't the thing. Todavía, it hadn't hit California then. It was mostly in those days. It was mostly I don't think they'd call them swing bands. They'd call them
dance band,
like probably swing, jazz, a lot of jazz and bebop and that kind of stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Bring them up from L.A.?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
But like, oh, this might have been a little later, like Beto is Gigi's either Fresno.
We used Beto. Yeah. We used Beto in the later days, you know.
Later days.
I think CSO used him more than ideal, yeah.
And Ray Camacho would have
Ray Camacho also played for us, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ray Camacho, Beto.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ray Camacho played for us quite a bit. And so we had some good, we put on some good dances. That was our main focus, and we did good at it. Yeah.
Okay, so in 1965, you've been working Carpenter self-help, but part-time, you know, when you're not working at that, you've done some things with CSO. Now CSO says that it was left CSO, and you're now going to start. You've been starting and working with organizing farm laborers. 65 comes a strike. Cesar says he needs people he can count on. He asks you to go to work on that full time. So, what is it you start doing then, as the strike is unfolding? What do you personally do?
I was an organizer, and an organizer is very broad, you know. An organizer means it's a broad term, I guess.
What's a typical day like then for you? What were you doing day to day?
When the strike started, we had to go and because there was still a lot of people working, you know. See, we didn't start the strike. The Filipinos started the strike. We were forced into the strike, you know. We weren't even thinking of strikes yet. I don't know if you know this little part or not. Has anybody told you that part? That it was the Filipinos that started the strike on September 8th, you know. Mm-hmm. And then it kept on going. They weren't going to get anywhere, you know. It's just like they did a strike like that in Coachella, but Coachella's season is very short, you know. And there was a very good price on grapes and those, and they didn't, so the growers met their demands. Just, no contract, just a little more money per box, you know. Mm-hmm. So they met their demands, so what, you know. So they did that in Coachella because there was a very good price at the first early grapes, you know. They were getting $22 a lug, or so another 10 cents a box was it's nothing, you know. So they, instead of hassling and all that they stayed in camp, they want to go to work. Says, okay, guys, we'll pay what you want. And so they won that little victory, you know. And they came to Delano and they thought they could do the same thing, you know, which was different, you know. It was obviously different, you know. And so they struck, you know, they were going to last a week or so, and they were going to go back, I'm sure, you know. But anyway, it has been a week, and by this time it was AWOC, you know, okay? The same one that Al Green and those guys, that it started to pick up a little steam again, a little. And so this was the ones that did that over there. So they wanted to do it in Delano. The Filipinos were with AWOC. And that was the same one that Dolores was working with in Stockton, with Larry Itliong, Filipino, and all that stuff. And so Cesar said, they got us all together, said, look, guys, you know, this is, our brothers are on strike, and it doesn't look, we're supposed to be, that's what we're looking towards, a labor union, and here we are actually breaking the strike because our people are working, you know. I mean, we have to. We can't do it. We gotta support them. We gotta pull our people out, you know. And we weren't ready, you know. See, we didn't even have any money. We did nothing. We were thinking about a strike 2 or 3 years. We actually, Caesar later said that he was looking to do some action, real action, in about 3 years. We would have been 65. Would have been 68, somewhere around there, you know. You know, start trying to, you know. We needed 3 more years of organizing to have ESC. We had done some organizing, but we weren't there yet, you know. And so anyway, he says, we have to support him, you know, just we have to. And then we took a vote, you know. We called a lot of people, all our people that we had contact with and everything. We called a general meeting, in other words, you know. And people came and, let's go on strike, let's support him. That was it. That's how it started.
Where was that general meeting?
It was at the Guadalupe Hall there in Delano, Lady Guadalupe Hall. And let's join our brothers. And so some of the Filipinos, Larry Leong and the other, were there present at the meeting, you know. We invite them to come, so we take the vote. And they spoke, and, you know, and then other people spoke. And you know how it starts, you know, yes, let's go out and strike. It's about time. You can, everybody start giving their opinions. And so they took a strike, and they took a strike vote. So next day, man, we went out there and just pulling crews out, you know. And that was a job, to go out there and talk to people. And once we got him out, talked to him in the evening, you know, had meetings with him and get him in committees and form committees and that sort of thing, you know.
At that meeting, I had remember from somewhere that Epifanio Camacho made a real fiery speech at that meeting. Is that, do you remember that?
Yeah. I remember that, yeah. Epifanio was, he's a leftist, that's what it amounts to, you know. So, yeah, he got up and made this, you know, Mexican speeches, you know, they're very good auditors, you know, it's orators, you know. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, he did, he got people rolled up.
What was your personal sense of notion of the strike? Were you supportive, opposed, scared, or somewhere?
See,
in between?
See, that was all new to us. It was we never had any, that was all new ground. We never knew what it was to go out and strike. We'd never done it. We'd never been in a strike, you know. That was all new stuff to us. We didn't know what was there, you know. It was just like, we're in this side of the world, what is on the other side, you know, the strike, you know. Nothing. We just knew that we had to do something. We had to support somebody, you know. And that's how it happened. It was, we knew, at least, I felt it was the beginning of something. Something. They're going to kick our ass in about 3 or 4 days, you know, starve us out or something, you know. And then that was it. Then we'd go with our tail between our legs and go back to work and, you know, usually what happened, you know. Mm-hmm. But it kind of lasted. We started, people heard about it, what was happening. The public came to our assistance, to help us, you know. The public, the American people got involved, you know. Mm-hmm. That's what happened. And then Caesar went and started went speaking and fundraising, you know, and bringing in money. That's how we kept going, because we had nothing. Mm-hmm. It was a good, it was the right time, you know. It was the 60s, you know, so what can I tell you, you know. everybody was trying to save the world, and we were part of it. We just happened to be there at the right time, I think, you know, and it happened. And so we could get people out, but the growers would pull all these people from this ranch today and pull them all out, you know. The guy had no workers for the rest of the afternoon. Next day he had brand new people in there, you know. I mean, the fields were full, you know. And then we'd go and talk to those people and tell them what was happening. There was a strike here, and so on, that nobody told us. And so we'd get those out. And you know, it was shoveling sand against the tide or something like that, you know. You know, we weren't getting nowhere, you know. We were just there, but nothing was really. We weren't accomplishing anything, really, you know. And so that's when the idea of the boycott was born, you know. I mean, we had we knew that we weren't going to win by we didn't have the means of beating these guys through a strike. They had more means than we did. They could go and get brand new, you know, because people are already waiting to work, you know. They could come in. And that's when that myth also, the myth before the strike was that if you weren't a Filipino, you didn't know how to pack grapes, you know. And that was eroded very fast, like, you know. I mean, that was, you weren't Filipino, you could do everything else, cut and everything, but you can't pack, you know. You couldn't, you know, you had to be Filipino. And that's
an interesting point, because one of the things that I remember, there was a little bit of tension sometimes between Filipinos and Mexicanos, at least in the farther north of Vancouver, where I was growing up. Partly because it is, they know that there are certain jobs that they said were Filipino jobs, they paid a little more, and the Mexicanos couldn't do them.
This packing
the,
grapes.
The packing, yeah.
Packing the grapes, yeah. Field packing.
So, and yet, even with that kind of a situation, everybody still voted to go with the Filipinos.
Oh, yeah. It wasn't a big issue in Delano.
It wasn't big.
No. It wasn't a big issue. And so anyway, we got out, and like I say, they would replace people until it was, this is started in September. It was already, all through a season, and then we went into the pruning. The pruning, also trying to get people out, we would get some crews out, but somehow they managed to bring in people from other places, as far as Texas and, you know, from Mexico and all over, and then they'd get the job done. We just couldn't shut them, you know.
Let's go back to real early days of the strike when you were having that kind of struggle, and you'd go out on the picket line all day then,
mm-hmm.
and get people out, and then when did you start going to Filipino Hall? You started using that right away?
Yeah, as soon as, once we kind of say, okay, we're in this together, then we don't have a place, and the Filipinos said, well, we have the Filipino Hall, and that became the headquarters, you know, like,
okay.
Sort of, yeah. Meeting place and yeah. The eating place, and we combined, everything was combined, we were one.
So at the end of the day on the picket lines, you'd return to Filipino Hall, everybody more or less would go back there.
Give reports and have the evening meeting every night, you know,
mm-hmm.
to give the reports and see what's happening, what they learned, what was happening, who did what, and there was a report. What was that?
Acorn, I think. Who were the, I don't know, the picket line leaders, the other important people? I mean, that took on important roles, leadership roles, mm-hmm. that came to the meeting.
Picket captains, yeah.
Yeah, who do you remember from those days that were?
Well, there were so many. We had a lot of people.
How many people would you have at a meeting on, you know, like the 8th or 10th day and then at night?
At night? That salon was packed, and there were some people outside and, you know, in the halls. And I don't know, 300, 400, 500 people maybe? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And do you remember who were the picket captains and?
Some, I remember some. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But those Esther's husband Manuel was one. Mm-hmm. Manuel Vasquez, Tony Mendez, Luis Valdez, Gilbert Padilla, Pablo Lopez, Tonio Dindain, on and on and on. There was many, you know. So, yes, a lot of.
Any women?
Yes, yes, there was a lot of women. Dolores.
I mean, that were picket captains.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah. There was a lot of women that were picket captains, you know. Mm-hmm. Esther was one of them. Mm-hmm. Esther was a picket captain. Dolores was a picket captain and had a crew, you know, mm-hmm. and. A lot of people that can't remember their names, you know. Okay. I can see their faces, but I can't remember their names, you know. It's so many years back, and it's just a long time ago, you know. There was a lot of people from early Marty. All Manuel's brothers were picket captains, you know. So all the Vasquez's were picket mm-hmm. captains, you know. It's a big, big thing, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And,
just on a side, Miguel Contreras went to work. Or was a union member, and his father was too. Were they involved early on? Was his father?
No, they came on. They came on later.
Later?
Yeah, they came in later. In fact, Contreras used to work for me. You know, mm-hmm. he was under me and working in the office. Mm-hmm. They came in later when we moved up north a little.
Any special memories of like the teatro and some of those events?
That became a real thing. That every night they would perform every night. You know, that was part of the happening of the spirit. You know, the strike spirit. We had to build up a lot of spirit, and by the time we had a lot of to keep it going, you have to build up a lot of enthusiasmo, you know, you have to get people worked up, you know, so they could, next day they're willing to go back and, you know, knowing that not too much is happening, you know. I mean, it's happening, but we're not gaining, really, you know. We can organize people, but that's not doing us too much good, because they can replace them as fast as we organize them, they can replace them, you know. And so you have to keep going, not to lose that interest. There was a point in, like it was in the... Caesar took off after the crop was over the first year. The 1965 crop was over. Like around February is a little lull in there, you know. And right after they're pruning, we still had the picket. But it kind of, people started, you know, there wasn't as many, you know, kind of almost died, you know. We had a lot of, you know, in those days we had a lot of people from the university, students, just poured into the lane. A lot of them were picket captains, you know, Ron Kaplan and I don't remember the names, you know, but I mean, just a lot of them were picket captains too, you know. They go out there and take their crew and, you know, and do their thing and all that, you know. It was a lot of them. And so at this point, there's no money. People have to go some, you know, people had to pay rent and there was no money, you know, and so other people went to other places to work, you know, or something. And anyways, we was kind of very, almost disappeared. But we kept the picket lines going with the volunteers, really, is what it was. And a few of us, like Esther, you know, all the others. And Caesar takes to the road to go and to tell a story and raise money. That's really what he was doing, to get bring in some money. And he's gone for a few weeks, you know, and I was kind of left in, well, sort of kind of a left in charge, you know, to keep the thing going. And it's almost, I could see it almost, you know, couldn't get people out to the picket line, but the volunteers were still there, you know, and they were also talking about packing up, and, you know, it's over, we'll pack up and we just go back to our places. And I knew that I couldn't let them go, so I know and you probably heard stories about People's Bar, I don't know, that was the hangout, you know, it was a little beer place that we used to hang up in. We're all young, so. I said, "Hijo," like I said, no money. Okay, in the first place. And so I said, "Mocha," the owner of the place, is a dear friend. We've since way back. We go for way back, you know. She was, And I went and says, you know what, Mocha? Says, and I told her what's happening is, I'm gonna need you to give me credit on a few pitchers of beer because these people are trying to go. And I want to get them drunk so I can stay here. I don't want if I lose them, I lose the picket line. You know? Oh, sure, Richard. Yeah, yeah. When you have money, you pay me. It's okay, you know. Said, or it's my contribution for something for the well girl. I don't know what it was. Anyway, we got it to work. Hey guys, how about some beer? Yeah, yeah. And the row was ready for beer. You know, we're young guys, people. And so we went out there and yeah, picture here, picture there. We started drinking beer, started playing pool and the jukebox. And they forgot about leaving that night, you know. So they kind of just, okay, and after we had some beer, you know, a few hours of beer and all that, just, okay, guys, we better go because tomorrow we got to get up. Oh, yeah, yeah, we got to get up early. And so I kept them, you know. And then they stayed again, started, that was, I thought, you know, anyway, I could have been wrong, but I thought that was the closest we came to the thing disbanding, you know. And we still had some of the old Filipinos that were there every day, you know, and, you know. And so anyway, I was felt very proud because I kept him. You know, I didn't. I thought of something how to keep him, not let him go. You know, and so I and Caesar came back, and I told him a story how I kept him. I was very proud that I had done this. How did you do this? Where did you get money from beer? Oh, Mocha, you know, just let me have a few pictures until. But we have to lose pay. This is. He said, well, I don't know where you're gonna get the money to pay that because you ain't gonna get none of this money here from here to pay for that beer. He said, but I kept this. I thought it was a great idea and what I did and it worked, you know, but he didn't approve of it. He says, no way. There's no beer for money. There's no money for beer. Yeah. I don't know where you're gonna get that money to pay for it, you know. So I don't know how I did, but I managed. But anyway, that was one of the stories that I thought I was doing something as an organizer to keep it. He came back and he had been successful. He talked to a lot of people, a lot of unions, and a lot of church. And so by this time, people know what's happening in Delano, you know. And money starts coming in, you know, start people sending contributions. So finally, when the next season rolled around, you know, all the work was done through, you know, we're picketing all this time, you know. And the grape season started again, you know. Caesar knew that we had to. We weren't going to win by being there, a presence on the picket line, and getting people out. Just not going to do it. So he thought about this and pulled us all together. One day and he said, you know, I've been thinking. He says, we're not getting anywhere the way we're going. He says, you know, we're going to have to do something different than this. I had this idea that if we go throughout the countries, as you know, especially the big markets in this, you know, we know that a lot of grape goes to New York, and you know, he had already found that out, you know. And we can start asking people not to buy the grape, you know, they can sell it, to, you know. We didn't know, it's a great idea, you know. But when he start telling his friends, you know, his other people that other. Not us, not his people, but other his friends, you know, like union leaders and sometimes someone. So, oh, Caesar's really blown it. He's really blown it this time. He's gone out of it, you know. Nobody gave him. How in the hell can you go out there and millions of people not to eat bread? That's ludicrous. That's just a net, you know, start criticizing, you know. And Caesar said, we have nothing else left to do, you know. We're going to do it, you know. To hell with it. We're going to do it, you know. We had no money to send people out on the boycott. They had to find their own way, you know. And so we had this big meeting and started assigning people. And you remember, there's a picture where Cesar has got a little vest. You know, you've probably seen the picture, a popular picture. And he's got a blackboard and he's got